My name is George W. Robinson. I live at 111 Bobolink Drive, Richmond, Kentucky. I am currently chairman of the Department of History at Eastern Kentucky University, where I have held a teaching position since 1956. I attended the University of Wisconsin from September 1946 until June of 1948, when I received both the bachelor's degree and the master's degree in history. I also attended Wisconsin from June of 1950 until August of 1953, working for the doctorate in history, a degree I received in June of 1956. I was an undergraduate student from 1946 to 1947, having attended Oberlin College for 4 semesters and Miami University of Ohio for 2 during participation in the United States Navy V-12 program. I was a graduate student at Wisconsin after September of 1947. I graduated from Cedar Falls High School, Cedar Falls, Iowa, in 1944, and briefly considered attending Northwestern University, but the United States Navy called me into the V-12 program at Oberlin College in July of 1944. I received my honorable discharge from the Navy in May of 1946. I decided to go to the University of Wisconsin that fall to complete my undergraduate work and to finish my Naval Reserve Officer Training Corps training, which was 3/4 completed. There was no NROTC unit at the State University of Iowa, and consequently, the University of Wisconsin was the closest school available with such a program. In fact, I wouldn't have been allowed into the University of Wisconsin if I hadn't been in the NROTC program, because due to the influx of large numbers of returning veterans and bloated enrollments at all institutions, nearly every state was limiting enrollment that fall to people who were citizens of the states, and entering Wisconsin was made possible only because of my Navy attachment. I was interested in Wisconsin for other reasons, though. It had been a family school. My grandfather was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin and had lived the rest of his life in Oconomowoc. My father was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin. My 2 uncles were graduates of the University of Wisconsin. My father graduated in 1916. One uncle graduated in 1914, and my oldest uncle graduated in about 1908. In addition to that, my oldest uncle, Edgar Eugene Robinson, had received an honorary degree at Wisconsin in the early 1940s. I think it was 1941, and that created a greater attraction for me for Madison. In addition to that, both my parents were from Wisconsin. My mother was originally from Jefferson, Wisconsin, and had even worked for a while as a secretary, I think, in the College of Education at Wisconsin during the time she and my father were engaged. I was never a freshman, consequently, at Wisconsin. I was actually sort of a junior, although because I was transferring, it was quite apparent that I would have to go to school for more than 1 academic year in order to complete the number of hours for the requirements at Madison. I did have new experiences at Madison because it was my first civilian experience at a college. And like all students in the fall of 1946, I experienced the tremendous pressure of enlarged enrollments, where at Wisconsin, for example, the student body of approximately 8,000 in 1945 jumped to 18,000 in 1 year in 1946. My parents drove me from Iowa to Cedar Falls, where my father introduced me to the man who would be my undergraduate advisor and later on one of my associates in the profession of history, William Best Heseltine. Mr. Heseltine had been a teacher in England during the last part of 1945 with my father. My father was a professor of government, and they had taught together some of the American forces who were not immediately returned home after the end of the European War, and thus the contact that was made at that point. Mr. Heseltine was a forbidding kind of person, quite frightening, as a matter of fact, to a relatively young person who didn't really act as if he wanted to advise me very much. He acted as if it was something that was an onerous duty. But as I got to know him over the years, I recognized that he was a unique personality, a man of considerable dedication to history, a man with a real deep love for humanity, actually, which he sort of hid behind a rather gruff and rough exterior. He was a genuine pacifist, believed in peace in a fundamental way, without affecting a great deal of attention or attempting to elaborate upon soapboxes, as some others did. He was a man for whom I ultimately developed a considerable fondness, of course, associated in the history profession. I had to take certain courses at Wisconsin to blend in with the credits I'd received from Oberlin and Miami, and I was technically a junior, although almost a senior. It would take 3 semesters to complete my degree requirements, and at that time, since Wisconsin had also been on the V-12 program for the United States Navy, they continued to operate what might be called a 3-semester system. There were the 2 regular 16-week semesters beginning in September, and then an additional 16-week semester which covered the early spring and the summer right into the beginning of the fall semester. This would be the last year, summer of 1947, that Wisconsin would have that third 16-week semester, and incorporated in it was also an 8-week semester. As it turned out, I had to take a course during the 8-week semester to meet my requirements, as well as a full schedule during the 16-week semester, so it was a pretty busy time. All of my requirements I discussed with a nice lady in the admissions office, and as I recall, I had no difficulty in setting up a program for completion of degrees. I do remember that there were extremely long lines for registration. I don't think it was any different anywhere in the country. I do remember a story that I think appeared in the paper about former Governor Phil La Follette having to stand in line for his son because his son had some other obligation. And of course, because of his reputation, he drew a considerable amount of attention. As I recall, we picked up our class cards in the old Armory building below the Student Union building, and then put them in little packets, and ultimately attended our classes based upon that. I took a number of history courses, primarily history courses, but I had to take some electives from a package of possibles in the College of Arts and Sciences. And out of those possibles, I elected to take an economics course, an English literature course, a beginning philosophy course, which was kind of a dessert course for me, as contrasted with many of the engineering courses that I had previously taken while in the Naval V-12 program. And I had to take 2 naval science courses in the first 2 semesters in order to complete 24 hours toward a naval science requirement. The naval science program was taught in what was called the Naval Armory, across from the First Congregational Church on University Avenue, not too far from Camp Randall. All the other classes were in Bascom Hall or buildings nearby, on the hill leading up to Bascom Hall. This meant a long walk from the area of most of my classes to my naval science classes, but there were many people who walked, and it was not considered a very great hardship. I decided to be a history major while I was at Oberlin College, actually in the second semester, and I simply continued that into the University of Wisconsin. Partly, I think, because my uncle Edgar, whom I mentioned earlier, was a rather prominent historian, and because I had found history up to that point challenging and stimulating and interesting, as opposed to some courses in physics and calculus and other engineering type courses that the Navy had in a sense required me to take. While I was at Wisconsin, there was no noticeable dress code prevailing. I think the girls, as was true most places, wore dresses much more than they do now. They didn't wear slacks or shorts, while the boys, for the most part, wore shirts without ties, khaki pants, or casual slacks. Many people wore remnants of military garb, since there were so many veterans on the campus at that time, since this was the big beginning of the GI Bill of Rights. And many, many people were in school under the benefits of the GI Bill of Rights, which I shared with him. The professors, by and large, were traditionally formal, wearing suits and ties, the types of suits that were not garish or very bright in color. The summertime, the favorite garb was the, what is not any longer true, but at that time, the famous seersucker suit. In the wintertime, it usually was a dark, conservative-colored garment. Students in class were expected to be attentive and polite. By and large, the classes I attended, particularly the beginning classes, such as the economics class or the philosophy class, classes that were beginning classes in those disciplines, were rather large, and because they were large, quiz sections were allowed at specified times, every 2 weeks, I think, or every 3 weeks, at which, for the most part, graduate assistants in that discipline attempted to elicit discussion from people, focus upon the principal points that the professor had emphasized or discussed or developed in the course. The average class in the lower division area was about 100, probably larger for some of the early courses, which I, of course, didn't take. The upper division courses generally had anywhere from 35 to 40 people in them, with a blend of graduate students and undergraduate students. I particularly remember a professor in Economics 1A named William Kiecofer, K-I-E-H-O-E-F-E-R, who was a rather dignified classical economist, and who presided over a rather large section, several sections, mine was large, at which every Friday a quiz was administered to keep people concerned with the course, and for whom a special honor was provided. Every Friday, the entire class gave him what was known in those days as the famous Wisconsin Skyrocket. Ordinarily, the Skyrocket was reserved for the end of semesters at the last period of a class, but Wild Bill, as he was sometimes called, received such an honor at the end of every week. The Skyrocket went something like this. Kiecofer. And if a professor wasn't prepared for this, as some visiting professors were not, they sometimes were startled at the initials initial start of the skyrocket because it sounded as if they were being hissed. But eventually they understood what was going on. As far as getting from class to class and getting to class, I carried a large briefcase with everything from small things to eat as well as books for all my courses in a particular day were involved. Getting to the class and getting to the university, which I'll talk about in a little while, was a rather extensive problem because of where I lived. And so I had to prepare and plan for each day from morning until evening. The professors generally referred to students when they called upon one individual or another as Mr. or Miss or Mrs. We referred to professors as Mr. Calling professors Doctor at Wisconsin was considered provincial, since everyone was presumed to have one, and consequently it was not necessary to affect that particular addition. Course objectives were generally explained at the class outset by instructors. Sometimes they were written down, but more often they were verbally transmitted to the class. In larger classes, a considerable amount of memorization was involved, even at the upper division level, and particularly was this true in naval science courses, one having to do with damage control and the other one with naval ordnance and gunnery. Classes met for 50 minutes. And beginning in 1946, they started all classes at 7:45 in the morning. In order to extend the day more lengthily due to the large student body, so that the first class would go from 7:45 to 8:35, and then there would be 15 minutes between classes. The next class would start at 8:50 and go 50 minutes and then 15 minutes and so forth. My parents were always supportive of me in achieving the best results possible, but they were also concerned about the importance of learning in general, and I never received from them what I felt was undue pressure for excess success in securing highest grades and so forth. That may be due in part to the fact my father was a lifelong professor of government at a rather prominent teacher's college in Iowa, and himself a doctoral graduate of Harvard University. Exams were for more than a two-week period at the end of each semester, always a two-hour comprehensive. Each exam was scheduled in conjunction with when the course met and clearly indicated in the course schedule, so that each student registering for classes knew when his final exams would be ahead of time, if he paid any attention to it, and was therefore able to, in a sense, plan for the final week a long time before it occurred. Blue books were used in the courses, but the students purchased the blue books and brought them to class, and then, of course, submitted the books that they had written examination materials in. Most of my examinations were essay-type examinations in history, English literature, and even economics. In naval science, they were objective-type examinations, and as a result, in naval science, there was a great deal more memorization of the different parts of a 5-inch gun, for example, or the various nomenclature of damage control aboard ship. Final grades after examinations were mailed to one's home address, my address being in Iowa, but usually I knew what I had received before those grades came, because in every course I took, it was possible to insert a postcard, which in those days was a penny postcard, I think, in the blue book with your name, address, an indication of the desire for both the final test grade and the final grade in the course. And as blue books were graded, the postcards were filled out and sent forth to the address which you placed upon it. And so you could receive them quite readily in that fashion. Sometimes you even received extra comments upon the card if the professor was so inclined to put those comments there. I remember one professor, I think in naval science, who suggested that I had just gotten through by the skin of my teeth in terms of getting a B instead of a C. Probably the professor who influenced me the most while I was at Wisconsin, and I'm trying to separate graduate school from undergraduate school, to some extent, although that's hard to do, was Fred Harvey Harrington, who later on became president of the University of Wisconsin. He was a marvelous classroom instructor, and in terms of graduate work, extremely helpful, stimulating, and very provocative advisor. We were particularly, all of us, impressed by his classroom ability to function effectively, clearly, logically, and interestingly without a single note. In fact, he prided himself upon his ability to take a particular topic, organize it in such a way, and present the cogent points and the interesting factors while walking about the room carefully and interestingly, and never referring once to a document or a note upon the pedestal. Later, I was able to see him affect this same kind of ability when he did a radio course over the university radio station without the walking about the room, since he was tied to one spot by a microphone, but he still was able to do it without the use of a single note. Even later, at a history convention, he did this in the formal presentation of a paper, exciting a certain amount of wrath from some of the other participants, particularly those who were supposed to comment on the paper, because as it would occur, he did not present exactly what he had submitted to them in written form before, and they were a bit concerned about commenting upon what they considered to be a rather extemporaneous presentation. But I think they were more concerned by the fact that he was doing something unusual than they were about its inappropriateness. He was an interesting person, a stimulating person, and was my principal graduate advisor during the period of time I worked upon a master's degree in diplomatic history from 1947 to 48. He was probably the best teacher and guide in the history department with whom I came in contact, but there were others who were also extremely good in various parts of the teaching responsibility. Merle Curdy, who was my principal advisor in my doctoral program, was one of my teachers in 1948, and truly a remarkable classroom teacher also. Others who were effective in the classroom were, as I indicated earlier, William Best Heseltine, Chester Easom, who was at that time the chairman of the department, and some others who probably I think of in terms of later work after 1953. While staying at Wisconsin, as I hinted earlier, I did not live on the campus. Because of the tremendous influx of students, Wisconsin took over an air base that had been set up during the war at what was that time the outskirts of Madison in the northern section beyond North Washington Avenue called Truax Field. And they continued to call it Truax Field, although while I was there, the occupants of Truax Field were anywhere from several thousand to 5,000 students at Wisconsin, a few married students, but primarily single students, going back and forth to the university, a distance of what seemed like 5 or 10 miles, in buses that were operated by employees of the University of Wisconsin, buses that were owned by the university. At Truax Field, we lived in what were converted barracks-type dwellings with concrete floors and partitions established to set up what were really quite comfortable rooms with desks that were provided by the university, cots of a sort to sleep on, much like army cots, I guess, and with ultimately a kind of special camaraderie developing amongst those people who were participants at Truax to establish a sort of Truax esprit de corps. I lived at Truax during the two semesters from 1946 through the spring of 1947. Then I transferred to a dormitory on the campus, Richardson House, it was called, right off Lake Mendota. And then after the summer, back to Truax Field for the two semesters I was in graduate school toward the master's degree, 1947 through 1948, June. The reason I stayed in a dormitory in the summer, two reasons. Truax Field was closed, and the dormitory was available because of the smaller student population during the summertime. Student housing at Truax Field cost $15 per month, as opposed to about $4 to $6 per week for a room in town. The summer dormitory was $240, but that included food, that is everything but the Sunday night meal, and consequently was quite reasonable, even though my principal income was $65 a month from the GI Bill. That $240 was for a four-month period, so it was about the same or perhaps even less than the $15, depending upon how much food I ate and paid for while I was at Truax. I had two or three roommates at Truax. Two in particular are memorable. One was from Plymouth, Wisconsin, named David Wolfe, W-O-T-H-E, who began as a veteran his college career at the same time I was beginning my junior year at Wisconsin, or part of my senior year, and I was happy to see him progress from a sort of uncertain attitude toward education to a very definite goal before he was through. Last I heard of him, he was involved in conservation work for the state of Wisconsin, having graduated with an agricultural degree. The other principal roommate was from northern Wisconsin. His name was William Kitze, K-I-T-Z-E. He was a very bright, energetic English major whose principal goal in life was to become a bartender in his hometown in northern Wisconsin. And from what I can gather from a variety of sources, I think he accomplished his objective. He was a very interesting person to know. All roommates were assigned, but the second year I was at Truax working on a master's, the same roommates were available, and we gravitated toward one another without any difficulty. We had house fellows for each of the wings of the barracks, and they changed from year to year, also going to school at the same time. As far as I can recall, there was not the sort of dormitory cohesiveness about which I had heard, simply because of the nature of living in a relatively rural and less than ornate style at Truax Field. We ate at a cafeteria which had been obviously the original cafeteria for the air base. We ate on trays, military style lines. The food was good, although like all food that is the same day after day, became somewhat less attractive as time went by. I do recall, though, that a sumptuous meal cost somewhere in the neighborhood of 65 cents, which seems remarkable at the present time. While I was at Wisconsin, I felt a considerable amount of pressure, perhaps self-imposed, to be successful in my desire at least to get a master's degree in history, work toward an undergraduate degree and then a master's, all of which was part of my objective. And so I didn't do very much in what might be called social, although I did get involved somewhat in student politics. I do remember in particular one movie that was attractive, although I didn't go to movies very much. It was the Al Jolson story. I guess that was about the time that it came out with Larry Parks. While at Truax, there were occasional open houses. There was some intramural sports, basketball and touch football. But we spent a lot of our time going to and from the university on the buses, which generally went from various points at Truax Field, terminating at the Student Union building, and then returning from the Student Union building to Truax on a regular schedule. If we missed those buses, we could try to get a city bus, which would at least carry us to the gate at Truax, and if the weather was all right, it was possible to walk the mile or mile and a half from the gate, or what had been the gate, it was an open area, to our point of rooms. So far as I know, there was no discrimination at the Student Union building or in the campus or at the various functions that took place socially at Wisconsin. In fact, for that particular time, there was, seemed to me, a genuine and relatively easy association of blacks and whites in the Student Union, in addition to what probably was a fairly normal amount of people from foreign countries. Probably not as extensive as today, but at least it was pretty significant then. I did very little leisure reading. I did mostly reading of studies in history, which didn't seem to be exhausting. In fact, it was so much a part of my focus at that time that reading a book or two a day was not an unusual experience and still left me with a feeling that there was a great deal more that I needed to do. I spent most of my time reading for courses, writing term papers, eventually, of course, working on a master's thesis in 1947 to 48, which I completed, as I told you, under the direction of Professor Harrington. I listened a lot on the radio to Wayne King and his orchestra, not a very modern attraction. Also listened to news quite a bit, but by and large, this was a period of time in which radio shows, although they continued to be important parts of radio, were beginning to fade in relationship to the coming of television, which I didn't have access to and therefore was not involved in very much. I did read the Daily Cardinal, the student university newspaper, and even wrote a column for it about Truax Field during 1947 to 48. The column was called Truax Tidbits and was based on real experiences, as far as I could tell, of different people I knew at Truax. I created a fictional character named Tommy Truax and blended as much as I could his experiences into those real ones that I heard about or saw or participated in relative to our everyday experiences with buses and eating and living at Truax Field. I sometimes exaggerated with a certain amount of editorial license. In addition to that, I edited the Truax, a mimeographed newspaper at Truax, which had the opposite of the New York Times motto, all the news that's print to fit. Many veterans were present at Truax, and Wisconsin being what it was and what it is, beer was in widespread use, along with beer cheese occasionally for parties and for other kinds of activities. But as far as I know, there was no use of hard drugs, and alcohol, which was pretty expensive for most of us, was pretty unusual. The legislature did, I recall, get upset, perhaps they did annually, about beer being sold in the Memorial Union building, but nothing came of it other than to allow some legislators to discuss it and talk about it and debate it during the legislative session. The beer in the union was, as I think it is today, 3.2 beer, which was not as stimulating as other beer that was available in most places on University Avenue. Football was a big event at Madison. The games at Camp Randall were major activities during the fall season, but the basketball team was far more successful while I was there in terms of winning the Big Ten, for example, in my first year. I remember in particular that Wisconsin, in somewhat surprising fashion, did win the Big Ten title, went on to play in a postseason tournament at Madison, Wisconsin, drew CCNY as their opponent, and promptly destroyed the New York team in the first half, leading, I think, 40-26. We were having a party at the time and enjoying it thoroughly. But in the second half, things were quite different, and Wisconsin lost the game, some in the neighborhood of 81-50, which indicated that they were turned around considerably by the other team, and our party lost some of its fervor after that. Boxing was also a competitive sport at Wisconsin at that time, and I remember seeing some interesting NCAA-sponsored boxing matches. In football, success was rather limited, and from the time I was first there through the later period, the opposition to the current football coach was a rather central part of interest in football. Football coach was Harry Studeldreher, one of the former Four Horsemen at the University of Notre Dame in the 20s, and many of the temporary buildings, Quonset hut-type buildings, metal buildings that had been constructed in addition to the use of Truax Field for the excessive student population, became the basis for painting messages to football faithful, the most frequent message being the statement, "Goodbye, Harry." And in fact, there was an unofficial club called the Goodbye, Harry Club formed, putting a tremendous amount of pressure, as we learned later, upon both the coach, his wife, and particularly his son, who was, I think, a senior at one of the Madison high schools in that particular year. The team not only didn't win, but Harry Studeldreher insisted upon using what was considered the antiquated system of calling every signal out loud in formation, which tended to slow the team down and cause a considerable amount of confusion. At any rate, failing to win contributed ultimately to his demise. I remember one of Wisconsin's former greats, Elroy Hirsch, returning to a number of classes in the off-professional football season. He was playing professional football, I think, for a now-defunct Chicago football team, which probably shortened his pro football career because he was physically manhandled by superior opponents. I also remember Harvey Keene playing baseball for the University of Wisconsin, as did Bob Wilson, both of whom later played professional baseball. Bob Wilson was also a center on the football team. And one star in particular I remember on the football team was a fellow named Jug Girard, who the rumor suggested finished with -4 credits, but he did manage to play a couple of years. He later went on to play for a while for the Detroit Lions. The major basketball star I remember, and he may not have been the only star, was a fellow named Bobby Cook, who scored quite a few points. Later on, Wisconsin was somewhat more successful in football. The name Alan Amici as a fullback comes back to me, but that probably was after 1950. I think the school spirit at Wisconsin was comparable to other areas. I particularly remember the thrill of hearing the audience at Camp Randall singing Varsity during the halftime ceremonies. I didn't see too many football games because the number of student tickets that were available was not extensive enough to cover all of the students who had swelled the university enrollment. Consequently, one was allowed to purchase blocks of tickets, both to football and basketball, and you got whatever they put in each block, which was approximately half the games. In most instances, I went to games when people gave me tickets. I usually didn't feel I could afford to spend very much money on that kind of thing. The major event of the social season at Wisconsin at that time was the junior prom, a school-wide affair to which several bands came and for which there was a prom king elected by the student body, who then, as I recall, chose the prom queen. I'm not sure that's exactly right, but I do know the prom king was elected, and that's how I got involved in politics. or at least that was the main objective of the politics, it seemed to me, that occurred at that particular time. I'll indicate that a little bit later. On occasion, I attended a church on University Avenue, which was similar to a church, at least in religious motivation, evangelical church, to one I went with a couple of my aunts who lived in Jefferson, Wisconsin, at that town. I participated in a primarily passive fashion, being particularly attracted to churches with large choirs and churches that sang, that had the choir sing a frequent number of hymns. I enjoyed the church music. I did not belong to a fraternity, partly because I moved around so much while I was an undergraduate that the opportunity really didn't occur, and partly, I expect, because I didn't really want to. I did participate actively as an independent, and I probably missed out on a lot of experiences because of this. There were large opportunities, as it seemed to be, for independence during the time I was at Wisconsin also. It didn't require attention to mutual loyalty or close cohesive association with groups, because it was largely a part of the Truax experience, which I mentioned earlier. I was involved in student government, not as a member of the student government, but as a participant in the politics leading the student government during 1947 to 48. And during that period, there was probably the only time there was an active and effective participation by an independent group that came to be known as the Truax Party, based upon 5,000 or more people at Truax in the student elections. The experiences I had were not only in assisting with the political campaign during that period, but in assisting with the campaign included such things as trying to paint over fraternity advertisements for the campaign on the Langdon Avenue wall, which probably isn't there anymore, and getting into, along with others, an altercation with the fraternity representatives, which led ultimately to flight from the scene upon the entrance of local police, trying to break up the general melee. It probably wasn't as serious as they may have thought. My other major participation in this situation had to do with the administration of student justice and the rules concerning how elections were supposed to function relative to the Truax Party and my position as editor of the Truax at Truax, a field. This got me involved much more intimately in student activities than I had been before, or probably would have been, and also it was relative to an acquaintance of mine at the institution, a student who also taught classes in foreign language by name of George Fisher. George Fisher was the son of a very famous American correspondent and writer of books on Russia, in particular Soviet Union, named Louis Fisher, who while in Russia as a correspondent in the 20s had married, well, perhaps even sooner than that, had married a Russian woman and had raised two sons, as I understand it, in the Soviet Union. Where he was located, he sent one of the sons to a Russian language school and the other one to a German language school. Thus, his sons were bilingual. Vic Fisher was married, and I didn't know him very well, lived also in the Truax area. George Fisher was unmarried, and while pursuing a degree at the University of Wisconsin, a graduate degree, he also taught foreign language classes in Russian. He was also very active in politics, and he was very effective in organizing, promoting, and inspiring a number of activities with which I became involved. He was the main reason I became the editor of the True Acts, although for reasons I didn't discover until later on. It seems that one of the rules at the University of Wisconsin in student politics was that no advertisement or campaigning for office candidates could be set up or promoted or financed that did not provide equal opportunity for all candidates. They told the story frequently about the ability of a wealthy candidate to pay an airplane to fly smoke rings in the sky advertising a campaign that would be disadvantageous to a less financially able group. But what it boiled down to in terms of my future was that George Fisher organized the development of the Truax newspaper. In effect, he became its editor, writer, etc. And in promoting the Truax Party, which he became involved with, presented all the Truax candidates, or a slate of candidates endorsed by the developing Truax Party, in that particular paper, but did not present the names of any other candidates. As a consequence, the newspaper and the Truax Party, or the people responsible for it, was charged officially by other parties, largely the fraternity party, with having violated the student constitution. George Fisher, being a part-time instructor, and I think also because he didn't really want to become that involved, persuaded me to become the editor of the Truax, and also persuaded me to take responsibility for having violated the Constitution. I'm not quite sure why I agreed to that. Perhaps it was George's persuasiveness. He tended to make me feel important by praising my column in the Daily Cardinal and puffing me up, perhaps beyond my normal capacity. But whatever it was, I went before the student court, which was a body of law students, with the chief justice of the student court being a senior law student and other judges on the court at various stages of completion of their work, with the assistance of a younger law student whose name I think was Hart Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, I'm not sure about that, who was prepared to defend me. Actually, George Fisher secured Mr. Meyer's assistance, and as I learned later, did not tell him that I, in fact, had not been the one who had edited the particular edition in which the violation or alleged violation occurred. As a result, there were several hearings, which I didn't quite understand, and which in the long run brought out a considerable amount of confusion, in that it appeared that the court and my lawyer found out that I really hadn't done it, and yet they couldn't get me to admit I hadn't done it, and as a result, a kind of impasse prevailed. The fact that the $25 fine loomed heavily on the horizon for perpetrators of such a violation was scary to me, but somehow at that point I felt that George would take care of me. And in the long run, the case was dismissed after the election, but it was an intimate experience, because I also got to watch the court in action with traffic violators and other various rule breakers at Wisconsin while waiting for my case to be heard on a number of occasions. I continued to participate, even though perhaps I had a criminal record or possible record in the courts of the student body, in politics, and as a kind of reward, I suppose, for my activity, I was nominated along with another individual who had been part of the Truax Party to be a candidate for student government in the election that would set up the student government for the following year. And I was happy to run for that. In fact, even had my picture taken at a student government funding expense when I discovered, or people in the admissions office discovered, that I had so many credits that I would not be able to be a junior when I would actually serve, and in fact might even graduate if other things worked out. prior to the time I would be on student government. The rule was that you had to be a junior or less in order to serve in the student government, which makes sense, and consequently, my name was stricken from the list. After that, I didn't participate as actively, of course, because I was getting into graduate school and some things were changing. I do recall that the other individual who ran for office, and perhaps this was part of my growing up process, who had been particularly critical, I don't remember his name, but he had been particularly critical of fraternities and sororities, before the end of the election period, or by the next year, had pledged a particular fraternity, and it occurred to me as I gradually developed some knowledge of what was going on, that he and perhaps a number of others in the independent movement were setting themselves up or establishing reputations in the hope that they would be noticed so they could be pledged to fraternities as well. This struck me as being a somewhat ironic consequence of a great deal of activity that had taken place in the political area that year. President of Wisconsin was Edwin Fred at that time, not a dynamic or forceful out in the group person, pretty much behind the scenes type, although as I look back upon it now, he exerted a pretty firm and consistent hand in university affairs. I particularly remember, although this was not during this era, it was I think in 1951, when Wisconsin won the right to go to the Rose Bowl for the first time in football. The announcements were made, I think, over loudspeakers, and I happened to be in the vicinity between the Student Union building and the library across the street. A message was read by President Fred in which he said the university was honored to receive the invitation, and then he went on to say, in the tradition of the University of Wisconsin, we will have classes as usual, which was greeted with a certain amount of disbelief by the students, but was reflective, I think, of President Fred's dedication fundamentally to scholarship. He was not close to students. Perhaps presidents in most institutions were not in those days. The main contacts I had with professors or with faculty were in departments in which I took courses, and of course, as I've already indicated, primarily with people in the history department, although I do remember, perhaps because I enjoyed both courses, Professors Ramsberger and Bogholt in the philosophy department, who were particularly important in contributing to the development of a formal awareness of certain philosophy, and a Mr. McCaney in political science, and a Mr. Stokes in political science, who impressed me in particular ways. The merchants on State Street were attracted to students, and particularly the opportunity for a great deal more business than they'd had before. Although I do remember that the first year I was there, Wisconsin had its traditional homecoming rally prior to the homecoming football game, and it was a night rally with a bonfire, after which a parade went down State Street, a somewhat disorderly parade, resulting in broken store windows and other assorted kinds of destruction, thus eliminating the bonfire night parade before homecomings, at least for the remainder of the time I spent in Wisconsin. There were four bookstores, and all of them were located within a very short distance of one another, generally offering the same kind of wares, books that were available and were set up by the faculty prior to semesters as being the books that would be in demand and required. What we did, those of us who were on the GI Bill of Rights, to take our sheets of paper with carbons on them to the bookstores to secure each semester a package of paper and pencils and various items of that sort, plus whatever books were lined up for the courses which we were scheduled to take. And those were provided for us signed for by us, and then the bookstore secured the funds directly from the federal government. Our tuition was also paid for directly by the federal government, so that our $65 a month payment, which went up to $75 prior to the time I left college, was what was left was for whatever other expenses we had, paying for rooms, paying for food, and so forth. The summer I spent at Wisconsin was a little different from the rest of the time at Truax Field. I secured, as I indicated earlier, the place at what was called Richardson House. I had a single room, which I felt would be more beneficial to me in what I considered to be a working summer of 4 months because of the 16-week semester and the fact I had to take a course in the 8-week semester, and enjoyed the opportunity to eat freely and without restriction at the included paid for area of food services. I hate to call it a cafeteria, although that's the way we ate because it was so much nicer than Truax Field had provided. During that summer, I spent a great deal of time in anticipating graduation in, at the end of the 16-week period from college on reading and finishing up certain courses that were required, which included that 8-week semester course in the American Revolution. That was taught, incidentally, by Professor Merrill Jensen, who also was quite frightening to a relatively young undergraduate at that time, but for whom I later on developed a great deal of respect and admiration, both because of his work in the area of 18th century history and because of the kind of person he was. The summer did involve, as I say, primarily completing these different specific courses that would meet the degree requirements for graduation, but it also involved some social activity with open houses at Richardson House and occasional dances at the Student Union, not quite as crowded as during the regular session because of the smaller enrollment in the summer, and a continuation of intramural activity. I had played intramural softball with the NROTC Navy team during the spring of 1947, and had played softball, as a matter of fact, while I was in the Navy. It was my favorite sport for participation. I remember, in relationship to that, that the coach for the Navy team was a Marine major by the name of Bruno Andruska, A-N-D-R-U-S-K-A, who particularly attracted my attention because, as a younger fellow, I remembered him when he played center on the University of Iowa football team in 1939, a team which had won all but one of its games, and which in those days played with 11 players both ways. He was a forceful coach and an interesting person who guided us through an undefeated softball season using the material that was available. That summer, I could have gone on a senior cruise for the NROTC, but because I could also graduate at the end of the summer, it was up to me to decide which direction I wished to go. And I didn't really decide until relatively late that I wanted to graduate at the end of the summer so I could go right on to graduate school and hopefully finish, as I did, my master's degree by the spring of 1948. As I look back upon it now with some greater perspective, I may have been impatient. I might have profited more from going on the cruise, graduating more casually in the following year, and working more casually for advanced degrees. But everything seemed to be moving rapidly at that time, and the objective became the academic one. I did receive my commission upon official graduation, which was September 20th, 1947. And then I began graduate school on September 29th, 1947. Not a very big jump or a very big gap. The summer, as I said, was one filled with some social activity and a considerable amount of study. I did play on the Richardson House team, which was not up to my standards as far as competition was concerned, and as a result, we were unsuccessful in most of our engagements. However, as I look back upon that also, it was maybe a lot more fun since we weren't under any kind of pressure to compete for a championship in the summertime. And I do remember, with some pleasure, an interesting assortment of associates in Richardson House, of varying ages and varying backgrounds, some of whom were regular students, some of whom were simply summer students, which acted as a kind of distinction between my years at Truax, which sandwiched the several months on the campus at Madison. I always had planned, I guess, although not in a very dedicated way, to teach in college upon completion of my work, but I wasn't as sure about it when I received my master's degree as I had been earlier, and as a result I decided not to go on immediately for the doctorate in 1948, but rather look into teaching to see what I could find that would give me a chance to test, try out, evaluate in actual experience what I didn't really know very much about. And that's why I didn't move immediately into a doctorate program. I taught for 2 years and then returned to Wisconsin in 1950 with the conviction that, in effect, teaching was the profession I wished to pursue. And I discovered what I probably was not fully aware of while I was at Wisconsin, that the university had a pretty high reputation among other academics throughout the country. And my first teaching position was influenced in no small way, I expect, by the fact that the chair of the department of the college to which I went was also a Wisconsin graduate. I think also the fact that the students at Wisconsin were a widely diverse kind, partly perhaps because there were so many veterans there and partly because that was the nature of the institution, it provided me with a wide variety of contacts, contributing to a gradual maturing process, which was, I think, important and influential in guiding me successfully in the teaching career. Of course, as I indicated earlier, my identification with Wisconsin as a family school, as a family location, as a traditional institution associated with the family, was an important factor, perhaps one I took for granted, but one that has been increasingly important as a memorable thing through the years. My brother, in fact, although he graduated from Harvard University after the war and service in the Army, did ultimately complete a law degree at the University of Wisconsin, and both of us received our degrees at the same ceremony in 1956. He, the Bachelor of Law degree, and I, the Doctor of Philosophy degree in history, at a memorable ceremony at Camp Randall Field, sort of capping, might be called, our respective educations and linking us to the University of Wisconsin as part of the family continuation over the past and many years from the late 19th century. In closing, I suppose I ought to sing on Wisconsin, but I'll spare you that particular experience and simply say that the University of Wisconsin, although not the only institution of higher education, which I attended, still remains as the main source of my educational inspiration and the basis, the most important basis, I think, for whatever I have accomplished in the educational field since.